listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, specialized programs, and many ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, joining us today is Dr. Will White. Will is the co-founder and clinical supervisor of Summit Achievement, which is located in Stowe, Maine. Now, Summit Achievement has been operating since 1996 as a licensed adolescent residential treatment program with a wilderness component. Now, Will completed his master's in social work degree in 1987 and recently completed his doctorate. His dissertation traced the evolution of wilderness therapy through critical leaders and incidents. Will's research was included in the textbook, Adventure Therapy, Theory, Practice, and Research. Joining us is Will White. Will, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, I'm glad to have you on the show, and as someone who has transported to many programs over many years, I thought it was great that you put together all of this information in regards to wilderness, because it's one of those things that I can be talking to parents or in sometimes with professionals, and they'll say, well, you know, I'm thinking about wilderness, and I realize that in many cases they don't really know the history of it. Or I'll have parents that will say, you know, somebody recommended that I go to one of these wilderness places, but I don't really know anything about it. You know, how did it start? You know, what was the thing that happened out there that somehow somebody figured out that wilderness therapy could help at-risk youth? So tell me this, what inspired you to research the history of wilderness adventure therapy?
Well, Alan, it's an interesting story. Many years ago, I had been working with kids in the outdoors. I was trained as a social worker, but I worked at a boarding school where they asked me to. At a boarding school, you never have one job. You know, you have to have several. So I was I had outdoor skills, having grown up in the mountains of New Hampshire. And I had learned a lot about outdoors, went to Colorado to get my undergraduate and graduate work, and came pretty skilled as a mountaineer. So I ended up at this boarding school, and at a boarding school you have more than two jobs. So they hired me as a counselor, but they also wanted me to run their outdoor programming. And I kept running into that I felt I was doing more therapeutic work in the outdoor programming than in the individual sessions, and became interested in the field of wilderness, and sometimes it's referred to as adventure therapy. And I developed a program called Prep for Success at this boarding school, and then shortly thereafter helped found a Summit Achievement, which is an integrated model that has a school base and then also an outdoor base. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But what happened, I started to research the history of the field, and the longest document I ever found was 18 pages. And different people, elders I would say in the field, would tell me different stories. Well, you know, it all started in Utah, or it all started in Florida, but the stories couldn't have all been true, because they seem to all have evolved out of a vacuum, you know, and so they would say, oh, well, you know, in Utah, it started here, and Texas has started here. And so I decided to, in pursuing my doctorate, to really find out, well, what is the story? And a story, since in the field of wilderness therapy, there's people who tell great stories, and there's mm-hmm. stories of stories. And there has been numerous articles written about it over the years. Over, you know, it's been around since 1861, is how I would describe it. All of this can be found in my doctoral dissertation. Anybody can Google it. It's called Stories from the Elders, Chronicles and Narratives from the Early Years of Wilderness Therapy. The first half is all a literature review, and the second half is interviews with critical leaders. But the beginnings can be traced back to, in 1881, a man named Ernest Balch. He was actually a student at Dartmouth College, and he had grown up a minister's son and learned to live, you know, farming and hunting in New Hampshire. And he basically said, I came up with the idea of a summer camp because I continued to see the wealthy, the sons of the wealthy who were lounging on the grand resorts. They would take their trains to the grand resorts like Mount Washington Hotel and the Balsam, and they would spend their summers, and they would be drinking, and their parents would be out engaging in, you know, frolicking in the hills or at the hotel, and the maids would be taking care of them. And a lot of these kids would end up at Dartmouth. And he was like, I've got to teach these young people how to have a sense of responsibility for themselves and the others, and for a sense of self-worth by being able to take care of themselves. So those are his quotes in 1881, that camp. And it was on, it was called Camp Jacorowa, and it was on Squam Lake in New Hampshire. Many of you might know of this, the same lake that they call, that the book On Golden Pond was written about.
Oh.
And so the original idea of that, of the first camp, is really about, was recuperative, restorative, was to get young men, it was a boys' camp, mm-hmm. to be more self-sufficient, caring for others, and taking care of themselves and taking care of others. And so it can be traced back to there. And what's an interesting, I've done this talk all over the country, and at one of the events, a friend of mine, who I didn't know, came up and he said, I got to tell you, my great-great-uncle is Ernest Balch. And interestingly, wow. He didn't even know that how the story connected. His name, Will Twombly, and now he works at a wilderness therapy program. So it's in the blood of that family.
Mm-hmm.
That was not therapeutically, you can hear the intention as therapeutic, but it wasn't for kids, were kids of privilege. In 1901 at Manhattan State Hospital, there was a tuberculosis outbreak, and they basically took half of the psychiatric patients. The state hospital was for the insane, of course, that's what it was called then. And they put them out in the tents, because they didn't want to infect them in the institution itself. Mm-hmm. And they started studying the beginnings of the research into how does the outdoor impact people with psychiatric is can be traced to 1901. So in these tents, what they started to find is the people with psychiatric illness with tuberculosis actually were getting better physically and mentally living in tents on the grounds, because the Manhattan State Hospital is actually an island, you know, between Manhattan and the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting better because they were staying outside, you know, walking around on the grass, etc., than the ones in the institution. And as time went on, they for about 8 years, they always had groups after the TB breakout had lessened. They always had tents, you know, had a group out in tents, and they seemed to do always better.
And so were they at that point starting to incorporate the same therapy that they may have been getting while they were in the hospital?
Absolutely.
They started incorporating it while they were in the tents.
Absolutely.
The only difference
is they were always outside during the summer and not, and they actually did a couple of years in the winter, but they seemed to be doing better on the same grounds, but in a tents, heated tents in the winter. Now by 1909 or 10, the administrators had enough of that. It was hard, you know, it's harder to manage. And so they came back into the hospitals. So in 1908, and again, if you look at my dissertation, you can see all the sites. Now, an interesting thing. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to share with everybody. So now, those of you, if you're sitting at your computer right now, the dissertation, can they also get to it through your website?
It is not on the website as of yet.
Okay.
You can get it, or they can LinkedIn on. Just put Will White LinkedIn, and you can pull it right up.
There you go. So those of you, if you're sitting at your computer, you know, you can pull up the same thing. You can pull up another screen. You can still hear us, and feel free to follow along. So,
Stories from the Elders, Chronicles and Narratives from the Early Years of Wilderness Therapy. In 1902, a guy named Ernest Seton, he was an outdoors person, so he had done a lot of work with indigenous people. And he comes back to his house in Connecticut in a town called Culse Cobb, which a lot of people don't know where it is, but it's actually not right next to Greenwich, Connecticut. So it's one of the last stops before you get back into New York City. His house is vandalized by some young boys who didn't have much to do. So what he did, he had already written a book called The Birch Bark Rule about, you know, how to do stuff, primitive living. And he wrote a book called The Birch Bark Rule, and he got the boys and said, I want to help you. We're going to create a tribe of boys, and you're going to learn outdoor skills. And he created the Woodcraft League in 1902. He gets a request from a guy named Baden Powell in England for the book in 1906, and Baden Powell is inspired to start what is now called the Boy Scouts in 1907.
Wow.
So in 1910, the Boy Scouts of America comes to America, but the influence was by Ernest Seton, and he was the one who brought the indigenous people and the primitive skills to Boy Scouts, goes to to the Woodcraft League, it goes to England, and then it comes back, and Baden Powell, and he says, I'm not going to compete, let's fold it all in to the Boy Scouts. And 1910 is when the Boy Scouts of America start. Now, what's interesting about the Boy Scouts is, if I do a talk in front of a lot of people who do wilderness therapy work or adventure therapy work, and I say, how many of you were scouts? The majority of the males in the room, and many of the females, will raise their hands. And when I'm writing this dissertation, I didn't have that in mind. It was just I started doing connections. I'm seeing this connection. I see one name. I was like, oh, it's Ernest Paulson. Then, oh, Paulson for Baden Powell. Then it comes back. And then I struggle, and at the same time, I'm kind of shocked because I was a Boy Scout. And I hadn't thought that, you know, my early childhood, how I was raised, and my parents taking me out and saying, you know, Boy Scouts is going to be part of your lifestyle, and our family lifestyle, how it inspired me. But it was when I helped start Summit. I wasn't thinking like, oh, I'm going to make it like a Boy Scout program. It was, you know, because I was a kid when I did that.
Right.
And so many...
I was gonna say, but at this stage, as far as kids going to Boy Scouts, it wasn't really tied into therapy, or it wasn't tied into at risk.
Oh, no.
It was just something that was a good thing for all boys to go through to learn those skills.
Oh, and after school activities, etc. And then you know, that's where you can first be inspired as a young person. And it has a rites of passage, and there's badges, etc., etc. And what you'll find is a lot of people in the field were Boy Scouts. And a lot in Utah, especially because in Utah, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the youth of that boys, that's the predominant, is they're really encouraged to be in Boy Scouts. So there's a connection there. And as we talk a little bit more, I'll explain that connection even more. Now, back in New England in 22, now during those times in the early 1920s and stuff, we didn't have a really big social safety net. So our religious or our ethnic groups would support us. And the Jewish League of Guardians of Manhattan, they said, you know, they were helping, you know, kids with mental illness who were Jewish. And they said, these kids can't go to summer camp. And by then, summer camp was really, you know, it was getting to be, get the kids, the industrialization, get them out of the cities. It's not good, bad for, another thing was in New York, it was so polluted, they were sending them upstate. So this group starts what is a place called Camp Ramapo. It was a summer camp specifically for kids with psychiatric and mental health issues. And it was staffed by social workers and psychiatrists. And that started in 1922. And this is, you know, this is 19, and there's research in 22 on the effectiveness of kids, summer camps doing outdoors, you know, canoeing, archery, rowing, knot time. We can trace that into 22. And Camp Ramapo actually is still in existence today. It's called Ramapo for Children, and it still helps young people.
That's great.
So that we have a very deep history that many people don't see, because some people say, well, you know, that's a summer camp. You know, wilderness therapy is in summer camp. Well, no, sort of the injury, the origins do trace back. And some wilderness therapy programs are kind of moving back to a camp-like model. Well, they're more in a summer camp.
It makes good sense.
Yeah. And then 1935, actually, the Mass General Hospital, with the psychiatric hospital in Massachusetts, or it's a general hospital, but they had a psychiatric wing. In 1935, they founded a camp. So those camps that were specifically with kids with mental health issues have been around since the 20s and 30s. And 35, what's important about what I like to mention, Camp Wadiko, is wadiko.org, I'm pretty sure, has a huge amount of research on their website that they've been doing since 35. So there's a lot about the effectiveness of this model. Now, in 46, something interesting happens in Texas, and it was this was by a group, and similar, like there was, instead of social service organizations, we had the Jewish League of the Guardians, and we had ethnic groups, things, but also there would be business people, and there was a group called the Salesmanship Club of Dallas. Now, they were wealthy entrepreneurs and businessmen, and they said, we've got to help a lot of our troubled kids in Dallas. So they assign a task to a guy named Campbell Loughmiller. Let's start a camp. And Loughmiller says, you know, these camps aren't, you know, it's not long enough. A summer camp's not good enough. I want to do it year-round. And so they were the first to do a year-round camp.
That was 1946.
46, yep. And so they would, and Loughmiller really wanted, he really emphasized the relationship, how important it is between the staff and the students, so much so that he really didn't want to have psychiatrists or anything like that. He kind of pushed the psychiatrists and psychologists away, and he had everything funneled through the staff, who referred to as chiefs. Oh. And it would go for a year, kids would sign up for a year at a time, and families would sign up. And he was very instrumental in saying parents need to be involved in that. He wrote a book about it. It's called Wilderness Road by Campbell Loughmiller. It's a classic in the field of wilderness and adventure therapy. Wilderness Road by Campbell Loughmiller. And he really talked about how the idea of help is through the relationship and that connection. And that model, he was the first would take the kids, and these were all kids with mental health issues, on expeditions for a short time, and then they would come back to the camp. They would build the camp was in Dallas, so weather-wise, or outside of it, it was in Texas, so weather wasn't so insurmountable, you know. Uh-huh. And and they would build their shelter, and they would cook over a fire, and they would also have mess halls that they would go to a couple times a week.
Well, now, as you were going through this, I would imagine that, I mean, all of this obviously is new information, but what surprised you the most, you know, about how this field evolved?
The connections, because as I spent more time, I found out, guess what, Kimball Loughmore was a Boy Scout also. And then I started studying about Outward Bound, and who was found by a guy named Kurt Hahn. Many of you may know him or know of his name. He was a boarding school person. He had actually exiled from Germany because he said, "You're either with Hitler or you're with me," and Hitler put him in jail. And he was able to get out because he had gone to Oxford, and he got some help, and he went to England, and he started the Gordonson School. And when he started this school, there were many sailors being killed, British sailors. And what they found out was the older sailors were tougher than the younger, more fit ones. And so he was asked by one of the parents of the school, "I want you to create a program that'll help kids be stronger, being able to take care of themselves better." And in 1941, he found Outward Bound.
Okay.
Now, so what's interesting about Outward Bound is that when they asked Kurt Hahn, you know, who inspired you? And he said, "Oh, I stole from everybody. I stole from Baden-Powell and Boy Scouts. I stole from Boy Scouts. I stole from Plato. Would you go to a doctor who said, 'I'm going to take your appendix out, but it's a completely original idea'? No, you steal from your best and you make it better." Now Hahn didn't write a lot, but he did. I got some copies of his talks. And this is an important one. In the 50s, he's talking about this. He starts Outward Bound 1941. There are five social diseases that Outward Bound addresses. There's the decline in fitness due to the modern methods of locomotion. There's decline in initiative due to the widespread disease of spectroscitis, watching people, the decline in care of skill due to weakened tradition of craftsmanship, the decline in self-discipline due to the ever-present availability of tranquilizers and stimulants, the decline of compassion, which William Temple called spiritual death. Now, think about that. He's finding this in the 50s. How much does that relate to our day, our modern day? You know, but that was another thing, is like how some of the things that have been talked about long, you know, you think that everything's original, and you're looking like, this isn't that original. But the way we're trying to help, and he did that by creating different things that the kids have to learn from. And if kids do really well on an Outward Bound course, they get a badge.
Right.
In his original, he actually called the Maury, his first program was called the Maury Badge, but the funder didn't like it, so he called it Outward Bound. Kurt Hahn hated the name Outward Bound. Now, another funny thing about Outward Bound is, or about the field, a lot of people think, oh, it's soloed. Solo. Alan, you know what the solo is? Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Solo is when you, in a lot of Outward Bound calls, some wilderness therapy, they say, "Hey, we want you to go out for a couple of days by yourself. You know, we'll be nearby, okay, but you're going to kind of retreat and reflect, and you're going to have a little campsite, and we want you to think about things." Well, how that actually originally started was in the second Outward Bound course. It was called Outward Bound 2. It was just the second course ever. It was in Colorado. This is in the United States. The original was in England. And it was all mountaineering and backpacking. And the actually, the food truck couldn't make it to the base. And so the lead instructor's name is Pat Tapley, who was a famous mountaineer. He says, pulls the staff together and says, "You know what? We don't have enough food for these guys for the next number of days. So what I want us to do is if we're going to teach them, you know, how to eat some berries and, you know, forage a little on themselves, and we're going to say this is reflection for yourself, But we're going to have to keep them separate from each other because they're really complaining and it won't work out too well. So we'll do that for about 3 days. And that's the origin of solos. That's why they started.
So it wasn't necessarily that it was something they thought was going to be this great therapeutic achievement. It was by necessity. And then as they did something by necessity, they then realized that it had some therapeutic value.
Oh, it became the standard. It was used ever since because the research is an interesting thing about Outward Bound. The research shows that actually most people remember their solo experience more than anything else 20 years post wilderness. Or they actually have seagoing programs. I mean, Outward Bound spread throughout the United States. It was huge. And then, of course, one of the people who was asked to help on Outward was a guy named Larry Dean Olson. Now, Larry Dean Olson, he grew up in Idaho, and he was his whole thing was indigenous people and primitive skills. He wrote a book called Outdoor Survival Skills, and he was known throughout the country. He was on that show, What's My Line? You and I remember those.
Yes, I do.
He actually, they hired him to be the technical advisor for the film Jeremiah Johnson because of his outdoor skills. And so Outward Bound says, we want you to teach primitive skills to the Colorado Outward Bound one summer. He does that, and he says, this is amazing, because he had taken groups out for a number of days, but he never taken them long trips. And when he did long trips, he did the training at Outward Bound. They said, hey, we're short on staff. Will you stay for the summer? So Larry says, sure, I'll stay for the summer, learn some more. Comes back, and he starts it at BYU, Brigham Young University. Now, Brigham Young says, hey, you know, we've had a lot of people dropping out. It's, you know, it's the 60s, and some of our young people are really losing their way. So he says, they said, we hear about your primitive skills trip. Why don't you take some of our kids that we've asked to, that we kicked out? And if they do well, they can come back. And at that time, he meets a guy on his first trip. He takes him, and I think it was 28 students and a nurse, and the nurse was 60. And they go out the first day, the nurse says, I'm not doing this. They hardly have anything. And that's where he meets a guy named Ezekiel Sanchez. Now, Ezekiel was raised a migrant worker, but he was a Totonic Indian, and he knew how to live off the land. And the two of them started almost a movement at Brigham Young University, and it was called BYU 480. And that was youth leadership through outdoor survival. And that was a critical program because so many people at BYU started to take that class and were inspired by both Ezekiel Sanchez and Larry Dean Olson. Another thing, both of those men were, but Larry had been involved with scouting. Ezekiel had been influenced by scouting. So scouting continues to sort of connect that. And then Outward Bound connected that, where people before had always been saying, well, you know, Larry started this, but Larry was influenced by other things, as other people were influenced by. I mean, if we really go back, we can go, you know, back to indigenous people and rites of passage, you know, but you could do a dissertation, you could start somewhere and end somewhere. Absolutely. So I decided to end it where it just started at the summer camp, the first summer camp.
Well, we're going to take a break, but we're going to be right back. So again, everybody, stay with us. We are talking with Dr. Will White, and we are looking at the history of wilderness. We'll be right back.
Found it. Over 25 years ago, to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Dr. Will White, and Will is a co-founder of Summit Achievement. Now, when we went to break, we were talking a little bit about the history of wilderness therapy. And Will, I'd like to ask, because it comes up, parents ask this of me, there has been some controversy about the field of wilderness therapy. What did you find out about that when you were doing your research?
Well, certainly there's controversies, and in actually any mental health field or soft science there is. And wilderness therapy has had its leaders, and that's what my dissertation was about, looking at leadership and how that influenced people and its incidences. Now, going back to that piece of Brigham Young University, BYU 480, Youth Rehabilitation Through Outdoor Survival, number of people started that, took that class, and learned the outdoor skills from Ezekiel Sanchez and Larry Dean Olson. And many of the programs people know today at SEUS and Aspen and the Expedition Outreach, Vision Quest, Wilderness Quest were all influenced by former students of BYU 480. Well, of course, there's one who was pretty notorious, and his name was Steve Cartisano, and he started a program called Challenger. Now, Challenger in 1988, the Challenger Foundation, is probably the most controversial in the history of the field because Mr. Cartisano really felt the need to use a much more adversarial or boot camp style. He had been in the military, and he felt a military in-your-face style was the way in which to do wilderness therapy, against much of the teachings of Larry, or all of the teachings of Larry Dean Olson, and certainly of Ezekiel Sanchez. And you can trace a number of deaths. Challenger Foundation did have a death related to sort of labeling or objectifying students as liars and kids who were very ill, didn't get the help. And there was another program called North Star Expeditions in 1990, a young man named Aaron Bacon who was very, very ill, and the staff thought he was faking, and he ended up dying in the field. There was also a program in 1990 called Summit Quest, not related to the Summit Achievement, but Summit Quest was out west, and there was a death there. Those deaths can really be seen, as, I believe, as more neglect and abuse. Those were staff who were not well-trained, and we're seeing kids as objects. And those are the majority, but they have had them. Those are the minority. But the majority of the press about the field has been about those programs.
Right, and that was kind of why I brought it up is because parents do bring it up at times. But the point being is that this is a field and actually goes back further than I even realized. But it's a field that has dealt with at-risk youth for, as you're saying, over 100 years, and has helped. I mean, I don't know if there's a number out there, but over a million young people. And if you have a number, throw it out there. But if they've helped over a million young people, and if there are three incidents, where something like this has happened, we have to really look at the statistics about it, so that we realize that, the media will shine a light on something that is negative. But the reality of it is, and for those of us that have been in this industry or have brought people to you know, these programs for many years, realized that there is so much value that has come out of it. And unfortunately, there have been a few of these types of incidents. But at the same time, people learn from those things and hopefully gain from it and move forward.
There's actually some fascinating research that's coming out. I want to give a couple your audience. There's the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Research Cooperative, obhrc.org, obhrc.org, which is that there has been research and evaluation of wilderness and adventure therapy programs in this through this website and through this group through the University of New Hampshire since 1999. They've just published some research that said actually wilderness therapy is safer than an at-risk youth being at home.
There you go.
So, and when I'm writing, when I'm looking through these old papers, I'm here, and then. Which shows research about the effectiveness, and then I read modern books or magazines that there's not much research on the history of the field, on the effectiveness of the field, and over again, I found qualitative research, quantitative research. There was a guy named John Walter who started a program in 1962 called Beckett Academy, and he had done a ton of research on the effectiveness of the programs. In 71, they did a program called Voyager. It's just amazing how much research there's been done and how effective it's been shown. But like anything, when people are hurt and when people die, which is not acceptable, it's not acceptable in any way, but there is a lot of press about them, but very little about how effective these programs are. So that's why I try to, just as like there wasn't much research on the history of the field, there's been much more research on the effectiveness of the field. So OBHRC is a great way to, great place to look at it.
Well, let me. I'm getting an instant message that's coming over right now that's from a listener, and this one reads, I am curious about how youth with conditions such as Asperger's perform in wilderness programs. My cousin's teenage daughter is in great need of help. The traditional therapeutic programs have not made any significant difference. Would a wilderness experience be something I could bring up and discuss with my cousin?
Yes.
Okay.
And what you got to do, what people have to do is they have to research each program. They got to find programs that are licensed and that have licensed clinicians. They have to be licensed by the state, hopefully licensed. All their clinicians should be licensed. So a licensed clinical social worker, licensed mental health professional. And that they have the skills to work with kids with Asperger's. And so really be a consumer who's discerning and ask for reference lists, making sure they are part of, that they're doing research, check about their follow-up, and talk to their, you know, former clients and say, hey, my child has got Asperger's and female, could you give me some names of a reference whose child had the same. I want to hear about their experiences.
Yes, and I was going to say, and we get calls sometimes after the shows where somebody will say, you know, hey, you know, my child is having problems and so on and so forth. Actually, sometimes we get them and they say, can you come get them? And I say, well, first of all, we don't know where they're going, so we need to find that out.
Helps, yeah. and using a professional who helps place, like an educational consultant, is actually the best screening mechanism because they're going to do 99% of the work for you. They know who's licensed. They know who's not. Because good leadership changes, and when leaders leave, you might find that then another group's come in who maybe aren't so experienced or they're more experienced.
Right.
And that's and they're going to be consultants will be an advocate for you to help place your child in the right place. And I think what's important is there's programs opening up all the time, and some are going to be better than others. And for someone to do that research for you is real important.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that I point out is that, you know, this is, you know, and many ed consultants spend half the year going out and visiting these programs, so they know the different nuances. Or as you say, that if somebody new has taken over, or if they have new people in therapy, they will or new people doing the therapy, they will go out, meet with them, talk with them, and have a really good idea if that's a good fit for your child. So, yes, I think.
And I think you, as the parent, has to do a lot. You know, getting the book, Adventure Therapy Theory, Research and Practice. Download my research. I made sure it was free. I wanted it. I wanted people to read, because there's goods in the field. There's bad. There's ugly. Now the field, I would say, is extreme. Is clinically sound and as safe as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly safer than a child who's at home who's using drugs and out of control, because they're going to be a lot safer in the woods with well-trained staff supervising them, helping them deal with the issues that they haven't been dealing with.
All right. Well, and I don't want us to run out of time, but I do want you to tell us a little bit about Summit, you know, as far as, you know, Summit Achievement, your program, and what motivated you to start that program back in 96.
That's good. Good book, and we started talking about this. So I was working at a boarding school, and at this boarding school, it was a time when that school was taking pretty much a lot of kids from wilderness programs. And what I saw over and over again, where the kids were really great in the outdoor program that I ran after classes, but they hadn't learned the skills to be in the classroom. They hadn't learned the skills in the dorm setting. So a guy named Chris Mays and his then wife, Candy Mays, approached me and said, you know, we want to start a wilderness therapy program. Both of them had worked at Outward Bound many years ago and had done some time working at a Vision Quest. And they had a friend named Adam Sattis. And so they approached me and said, hey, we hear you, you know, you have been in New England for a while. They had lived in the same town that I did, but they had been most of their time on boats or on expeditions, so they hadn't been there at the house. And so they said, we want to start a program. I said, well, great. I'd be interested in starting a program with you, but here, a couple caveats. One, I was at that time, I was certainly 96, I had already been licensed 10 years as a mental health professional, as a clinical social worker. And I said, if we're going to start, we're going to be licensed. The program's going to be licensed by the state as a mental health, a residential treatment center one, because I was, you know, I wanted it to be a high level license. I wanted external people coming to review us to make sure we're doing the right thing. And I was also taking care of myself, because if I'm operating as a licensed professional, unlicensed program, then, you know, I'm the higher standard. And I wanted the program to be held. And then I said, I really, really believe the field needs school, you know, academic piece. Now, that's not for all kids. Some kids are not ready to be in school. But our students go to school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then they go out on expedition Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They come back. Now, when I was talking a little bit before, the field court sort of split in the 80s. So there was one strand which would you can trace back to, so like the Aspen Achievement, and you can see Second Nature. You can see a lot of programs that really took the primitive style. Primitive skills side, bow drill, fires, etc. And then there's another style which took more of a mountaineering influence, more of the pure Outward Bound backpacking. And myself and Chris and Adam and Candy had been more mountaineers. And so we really used the metaphor. Summit Achievement is the metaphor is climbing. And so we go backpacking. And I also felt as a social worker, a very strong piece of the family component. So actually, the first week a family is coming, we're going to sit down and start doing family therapy sessions by phone nowadays with technology on Skype.
Right.
And we're going to do that every week that a student's with us. And the field's changed. You see many more programs integrating that family component much more than years ago. I remember when I first started, I had some people pull me aside and said, you know, the therapists are ruining the field. they're making it, you know, these clinicians, they're making it too soft on the kids. And I know some people today still feel that. But, you know, all of us in the field are actually held to a high standard of care,
uh-huh.
as we should be, because we're dealing with vulnerable kids and vulnerable families. You know, one of the interesting things, a lot of people think, oh, you know, the wilderness therapy programs, the things that have happened, actually less has happened in wilderness therapy programs in the last number of years than have happened in traditional non-therapeutic programs. And I'll talk to you about, you know, in I think it was 2006, there was two deaths in one area of Utah related to heat stroke. And both of the deaths were not therapeutic programs, but they had young people. So they had teenagers and young adults hiking. Uh-huh. Now in Utah, when you're above 90 degrees and 90% humidity, nobody's allowed to hike.
Okay.
That's if you're running a licensed treatment or a wilderness therapy program. But the programs that don't have to follow guidelines, those two deaths happened there. And that was I'm pretty sure it was 2006. So the field is actually becoming more and more safe. Now Summit, what's interesting about Summit and continues, if we're continuing to evolve with technology, so we're actually, our students can take, they have a choice of 140 classes they can take, coursework, and we do a blended learning model. So they're in school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and they're having a teacher there to help them, but they're online working on their curriculum and having teacher's assistance. So a student who may be working on calculus can be with a student who may be working on algebra, but individually they're working on it, but they have the time with a teacher who can help them work on their school thing. So they can get credit recovery there.
Now, yeah, I was going to say about that. Some of the parents that are out there listening, give us a description of what you kind of envision as the student that is a good fit, the young person that is a good fit for your program.
Well, our students cannot be under the age of 13. And so
okay.
We have 13 and the oldest is 20, and we keep there's different ages, different groups per age, and also we have our male and female separated. So we're going to take a lot of our students may be mildly oppositional defiant. Now, mildly versus a fully oppositional defiant. A fully oppositional defiant kid is probably not unlikely to come to Summit because they might need a higher level of intervention, maybe a program that doesn't have the academic component, and they're going to be in more in the desert or not, or a higher, what I would call a higher impact wilderness program. Maybe kids with learning disorders. Certainly we have a number of students who are on the spectrum, so that the person who had texted you earlier may have Asperger's, may have nonverbal learning disorder. We certainly work with kids with mood disorder.
And it sounds like, now, are they also able to catch up? Because we, you know, we hear of a lot of kids that have just, you know, they've started to kind of go off the path a little bit at school, and which has also caused them to fail some classes, so they're really behind. So, you know, if they're dealing with some issues and they go to you, is it the type of thing they can also get caught up, which we knew also really helps self-esteem?
Absolutely. They can. Hopefully we can help them in their learning to catch up and recover credits that can then be used back. We have yet, we are partnered with a group called Blueprint Education, and since we've partnered with them, we haven't had anybody not accept their credits. So it's, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what's the average, if there is one, length of stay?
Our average, our program in the shortest form would be take 6 weeks, but that would be somebody very, very invested in it. Average is about 8 weeks.
Okay.
A lot of it has to do with the investment or the stages of change. You've probably heard stages of change, which is pre-contemplation, contemplation, determination, action. So where they are in the stage of change. Now, we do a research, and I'll continue going back to we have been doing research, and if you look at the obhrc.org site, we are part of many of the studies. And so we have a fair amount of data on. So as soon as a student comes to our program, we're doing some evaluative work, and then we do at the day they discharge, and then we do three months after, then 1 year, so we can do some longitudinal studies. And most of that is published on the obhrc.org site.
And Will, I was just say one more thing, because I just looked, and we are really just about out of time. We've got about 30 seconds. What are you doing now? Tell me what you're doing.
I am continuing on as clinical supervisor at Summit Achievement. I am working on a book because of my dissertation, again, it was Stories from the Elders, Chronicles and Narratives from Early Years of Wilderness Therapy, or it's on Will White and LinkedIn. I'm just finding more and more stuff, so I want to make it into a book and get it out there to people.
How soon? Book's coming out.
How about I say 6 months?
6 months.
That'll give me a good deadline.
Okay.
And I'm helping some other organizations open up some new programs, one called Pinnakees. It's an island off the coast of Cape Cod. It's going to be a substance abuse program. And actually a consulting group doing Mountain Valley Treatment Center and anxiety treatment program. So I'm really excited about what's going on in the field, and certainly open to having people contact me if they have questions.
Okay, and again, if anybody needs to, they can contact you. They can go to www.summitachievement.com contact this show, and we will help you. We'll put you in touch with Dr. White. So, Will, thank you so much for coming on. I wish we had more time, but now that we put it out there that you're going to have this done in 6 months, let us know, and we'll have you back on when the book's out.
I really appreciate it, Alan. Thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.